So I want to get that on the recording as well. Let's start with the ability for people to be able to defend themselves legally, because lawfare is how the folks come after us. And we were just talking about how the financial aspect has to play a role, because it's all about it's not about having money, lying around and doing frivolous things with it. It's about surviving. And when they threaten your ability to survive, then that's everything. Then there are decisions that need to be made, and there are priorities that need to be set. So start us off there with the importance of being able to defend yourself in a legal setting when your rights are being infringed upon.
Well, I mean, it's the only real avenue we have to seek redress of a wrong that's been done to us, right? When we've been harmed in some way or another, whether that's a physical harm, whether that's a financial harm, some other kind of harm, the only way to seek redress in an expeditious manner or somewhat expeditious manner, I've used that term loosely, but
Right.
a somewhat expeditious manner is the courts, right? Because trying to get the law changed, I mean, good luck. You could be fighting that for decades and you still may never get anywhere. And that still isn't going to get justice for you. It's not going to give you any damages, any relief, any compensation for what you've suffered. So, really, what it comes down to is the courts are our only avenue. It's the only peaceable avenue to seek redress of a wrong, to seek justice. Yes, we hear people all the time talking about taking it to the streets and protesting, and some people even getting violent. We don't endorse that, obviously. We do endorse peaceful protest, exercising your First Amendment right, in a peaceful manner, and having any kind of using your voice in any kind of legal forum that you can. Obviously there are limits to that, and people want to act like there aren't, but there are limits. It has to be in a public space. You're not going to charge onto someone's private property and start doing that. We do have private property rights in this country too. So, there are limits to all of this, but that doesn't really get you anywhere either. I mean, when the religious exemption was repealed in Connecticut, the religious exemption for mandatory school vaccinations. So in Connecticut, like in every state, there are immunizations that are required by law for children to attend school. Now, we can get into a whole discussion as to whether that should be legal. Supreme Court has said since 1905 that it is. You might not agree with it. You might think that should Jake the Jacobson decision needs to be overturned, and I might agree with you, but as the law currently stands, they can do that. Okay. So what's the only way to opt out? The only way to opt out is either for a religious reason, in some states, a personal philosophical reason, personal belief, or a medical reason, medical exemption. You can't opt out. In
Is
Connecticut, they had a religious.
that personal belief thing kind of like a conscientious objector clause, kind of like that in the military?
Yeah, it would be similar. And actually, I've used those cases to explain why we should, because certainly you have that freedom in the military, right? And the Supreme Court has honored that freedom. We certainly then we should have religious freedom to opt out of vaccinations in the civil context, right, for civilians. And I've cited cases like Welsh versus United States, and the cases from the Vietnam War era, conscientious objector cases. I definitely think that there's an argument to be made there, but the point is, Connecticut had always had a religious exemption as part of its mandatory school vaccination statute since 1959, when that statute was first enacted to require vaccinations for school attendance. It had always had this religious opt-out and then a medical opt-out as well. So that stood for decades since 1959, and suddenly in April of 2021, well, it wasn't that suddenly, they were actually planning it for years, but look at the year, and that'll tell you something about what helped them get this across the finish line. 2021, what was going on in the country, in the world in 2021, that would have prompted people to have so much support behind repealing the religious exemption? Obviously, we know it was the COVID
The little
hysteria,
thing
whatever you
called
want to
COVID.
call it. And so they passed it. April 28th, 2021, they repealed it, even though there was zero evidence. that the religious exemption was causing anyone any harm, was causing any outbreaks, any kind of public health emergency, they went ahead and repealed it. The day that Governor Lamont signed that into law, which was in April 28th, 2021, within about 3 or 4 hours of him signing that, we stood, myself and our attorneys here at We the Patriots USA, stood on the steps of the Connecticut Supreme Court in Hartford, and we vowed that we were going to be filing a federal lawsuit, which we did 2 days later, and that we were going to take this all the way to the United States Supreme Court if necessary, and we believed it would be necessary. Well, 3 years later, that's exactly where we find ourselves. In December of last year, December 11th of 23, we filed a petition, what's called a cert petition, to the United States Supreme Court. That is currently under review by the court. And just this February, something really extraordinary happened, something fairly uncommon, something we were not expecting, really. But the state had waived its right to respond. Now, that part's not extraordinary. The government often waives its right to respond to your petition as a legal strategy, as a way of signaling to the court, this isn't really worth your time. We're not even going to give it our time. We're not going to respond to it. They're allowed to waive their right to file an opposition brief, and they did. On February 5th of 2024, just a couple of months ago, the United States Supreme Court, however, ordered them to respond to our petition. Huh. And that was huge. That was groundbreaking when that happened. Other people who are not lawyers weren't necessarily jumping up and down and cheering. I was. People, we made a big legal announcement, but most people didn't really catch on to the significance of that. Only about 1% of the cases that are appealed to the United States Supreme Court get granted. The petitions right. get granted. So right. out of between 7 and 8,000 petitions are filed every year, only about 80 are granted. Most of them, they don't even get put on the discuss list to be discussed at the justices' conferences, yeah. let alone get granted. The fact that they took an affirmative action here and said, you're going to respond to this, shows that at least one justice and his or her clerk are looking at this pretty carefully and are seriously considering granting this now. Does not mean they're going to grant it. Right. We don't have any guarantee that this petition is going to be granted. So I want to make that perfectly clear. That's not up to me, that's up to the justices. Yes. But only 4 out of the 9 have to agree to take our petition, not the majority.
Right.
To get a majority decision, of course, you need 5 out of 9, right?
Right.
But only 4 out of the 9 need to decide to take up our petition. So we like our chances, certainly since the state has now, been ordered to respond, and they will have, as it currently stands, unless they're granted any more extensions, as it currently stands, they have until April 22nd to file a response brief. And then we have the opportunity to file a response to their response, a reply brief. And then there'll be probably at least 5 conferences of the justices between this time in May, when we file our reply, mm-hmm. and when they adjourn the first week in July. So there'll be about 5 conferences at which they'll have an opportunity to take up our case and decide whether to grant it. If they did grant it, it would be put on the calendar most likely for next October or November. There'd be a hearing. And then if we get that hearing, a decision would issue sometime early next year. So even if they grant it this spring, you're looking at, the end of the year for a hearing and then early next year for a decision. But honestly, that's pretty fast. Some cases take 5, 6, 7 years or more to get to the Supreme Court. We're only 3 years in, and it's already under consideration, and we already have the possibility of getting a hearing granted. And I cannot overstate the importance of this case. This is the most significant case in the history of medical freedom.
And it's flying under the radar for the most part.
In our lifetimes. I was originally going to say within the last 20, 25 years, but honestly, this could be the most significant case since Jacobson in 1905. So you're talking about 120 years or so of jurisprudence that has not really been favorable to religious exemptions when it comes to vaccinations. If they rule in our favor on this case, that's going to turn the whole thing on its head. And it's not going to overrule Jacobson, I don't think, but what it is going to do if we win, and I like our chances if they grant our petition, if we win, you're talking about not only restoring the religious exemption in Connecticut, but you're talking about winning it back in California, in New York, in Maine, and for the first time ever in West Virginia that doesn't have one. Their governor just vetoed a proposal by the legislature, a bill by the legislature to, for the first time ever, have a religious exemption to school vaccinations. He vetoed it just a couple weeks ago. Wow. They've never had one in West Virginia. So, and then all these other states where it's being threatened, like Massachusetts, New Jersey, places like that, all your favorite blue states, it would provide a protection that they wouldn't be able to do away with the religious exemption in those states. So this is a hugely significant case because pharma and their lobbyists have been hard at work in state legislatures for years now. California was the first to lose its exemption, its personal belief exemption, which was in 2015. So now all they have is medical exemptions, and it's nearly impossible to get even one of those in California. So California has virtually no opt-out for school vaccinations. In a state like that, your option is basically homeschool or leave the state.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I love the fact that they cite that one of the reasons for doing away with the exemption was falling vaccination rates. So that reads to me as they felt their grip kind of loosening a little bit on this industry that they have. And they were like, well, wait a second, we got to kind of cut out the excuses and make this even more mandatory.
I mean, it's not even true, though, right? Connecticut still, I mean, yes, maybe the vaccination rates had fallen minimally, but it still had one of the highest vaccination rates for MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, in the entire nation. It was, I think, 95 or 96% or even 90, it might have even been 97% as of the most recent data. Several years ago, I remember the governor of Connecticut had released a statement praising that we had the highest rate in the whole nation of vaccination. So for MMR, which is the shot they were most concerned with. They were saying measles. That they couldn't say COVID because COVID wasn't on the required childhood schedule or recommended childhood schedule, I should say. And it wasn't a required shot in Connecticut for school attendance. It still isn't. So they couldn't really use COVID, even though that was in the background. They were using it as an example during the public hearings and everything, saying, oh, look what's happening now. That could happen with other things like measles. So they were using it, but they couldn't directly use it and say, we need to have COVID shots, the number of COVID shots, you know, increased in the state, because this bill had nothing to do with COVID shots. So they were using measles. They were trying to harp on measles, but we had one of the highest rates in the entire nation, and we had no evidence of any measles outbreaks caused by using a religious exemption or really anything else. There were no like major outbreaks of that illness in the state of Connecticut in decades, really. There hadn't been. So to try to create this fake public health emergency and use that as a justification for taking away the religious exemption was just so ludicrous. And the evidence so clearly demonstrates that they didn't have any compelling government interest to do this.
Yeah.
Why is that significant? There's a case called Employment Division v. Smith, and that's at the heart of our brief. If you read our brief, you see our brief's not about Jacobson, because we're not going to win by attacking Jacobson, okay? The police power to mandate vaccinations, the Supreme Court has consistently ruled the state has that. This court has indicated no willingness to overturn that. This court will not overturn that. We'll not see that in our lifetimes or maybe even the next generation. I don't know if we'll ever see it. That's why we need to preserve the religious freedom. The reason for that, you know, I can sit here and say I disagree that their police power allows them to mandate vaccinations. It doesn't matter what I say, though, because I'm just one lawyer and I don't have any power or authority that's binding. So it really doesn't matter. And there is nothing in the Constitution that preserves your right to bodily autonomy. People think there should be. They thought for many decades there should be, and the court recognized that for many decades in Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey and subsequent decisions. But in the Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Center, the decision that came out in 2022,
yes,
the court very clearly stated that there is no right to bodily sovereignty, bodily privacy. There's no privacy right over one's body in the Constitution. And whether you agree with it or not, it's correct. I challenge anyone to find the words bodily privacy, bodily sovereignty, anything to do with, you know, health rights, health rights over one's physical body. There's a right not to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. But it doesn't say there's a right to be free from any kind of medical mandate. That's not in the Constitution. So you might think it should be, and maybe you want your state constitution to be amended. Maybe you want the U.S. Constitution to be amended. Wonderful. Go for it. Good luck. It's not going to happen in our lifetimes. People don't like me saying that, but I'm not here to say what people want me to say. I'm here to tell people the truth. And the truth is, the only way you're going to preserve your right to opt out is, quite frankly, through religious freedom, which we do have over 200 years of very strong jurisprudence in this country that protects your religious freedom. And this court in particular has been, in my lifetime, 4.5 decades plus on this planet, the most favorable court to religious freedom in my lifetime, possibly even in the previous generation. This is an extremely, extremely strong court when it comes to preserving religious freedom, religious liberty. And for that reason, our best chance of preserving our rights to refuse is to have those who have sincere religious objections to vaccination, like myself and the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, step forward and proclaim that right and defend that right. Because if you're just focused on the mandate all day and saying we have sovereignty over our bodies, mandates should all be abolished, that's not happening, folks. You don't want to hear that, but it's not going to happen. Okay. Absent a constitutional amendment, that's not happening. The court's never going to side with you on that. All right. It's not going to happen. You're wasting your time. You're wasting your money. You're wasting your efforts. The best way is to preserve the opt-out. People don't like that because they come to me and say, well, religious exemption is, by using a religious exemption, you're consenting or admitting that they have the right to mandate in the first place. I think that argument is bull, because I think it's just recognizing reality that that's the way the courts ruled. That's the way they've ruled for over 120 years. They're going to continue ruling that way. Any lawyer worth his salt knows that and will tell you that. So, you know, you have to operate in reality. I can say I want to live in this world where mandates are illegal and they're unconstitutional. But if there's actually nothing in the Constitution that says that they can't do that, and the Supreme Court has said they can, I don't see how you're ever going to win. And I don't want to waste our donors' money on causes that are not going to lead to victories, because litigation is extraordinarily expensive. So if I'm going to spend our very limited resources on a case, I want it to be a case that's actually going to get us a W. And I strongly believe this case can get us a W. And, you know, religious freedom is deeply personal, too. It's not really something they have the right to question. You know, people have all different kinds of religious beliefs. All right. And that's personal between you and God. And so claiming a religious exemption should not really be a difficult thing to do. We just have to preserve the right.
Here's what I think is different about this particular case is just that. I mean, you know, if you ask anyone on the street about the First Amendment, they always say, well, it's the freedom of speech, right? That's the one that's kind of people think of first. But the First Amendment, the language, if you read the language, it starts with freedom of, I mean, this country was founded by people who are being persecuted religiously and sought freedom from that. That this is the amendment. It's religious freedom. And so I think that I mentioned to you before we hit the record button here that I was reading this brief. And it's, I mean, it's pretty, pretty tight. And it's pretty, I'm not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV, but it's on solid, solid ground. And so it's, you know, I share your optimism because I think this is something that the court would want to take up, and it seems to me to be a question that people would want to clear up finally. You know, hey, look, this is about your freedom to practice your religion. And if you have an exemption to putting things in your body that you don't believe in, well, then, hey, you should have the right to make that call in the final analysis.
I agree. I agree 100%. And, you know, what I was getting to, I realized I didn't quite get to my point there. The reason why the state has been able to get away with this, so to speak, is because they have that shield of a case called Employment Division v. Smith, which is the case that we're attacking here.
Yes.
We're not attacking Jacobson because that's the police power I've already explained. That's not going to get us anywhere. We're attacking Employment Division v. Smith because that's the case that when it comes to religious freedom, gives the state a shield. They don't have to prove, they don't have to meet the burden of strict scrutiny analysis. Strict scrutiny would mean they would have to prove that there was a compelling government interest, such as a public health emergency, that warranted this action, and that they did this by the least restrictive means possible. They clearly, in this case, if you look at the facts, can't meet either of those burdens, but right. They don't have to. Why? Because of a case called Employment Division v. Smith. In 1990, the United States Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state of Oregon, who had denied unemployment benefits to a group of Native Americans who were using peyote, which is a hallucinogenic, as part of their religious ceremonies practices. And they were denied unemployment benefits because they'd been fired for using peyote. And they said that's willful misconduct. So under the statute, workers' unemployment compensation statute, we don't have to give you benefits if you're fired for willful misconduct. And they challenged the Oregon law and said, well, that's not even constitutional because we have a right to practice our religion, right? And they said, no. The court in that case said, if it's a neutral law of general applicability, then you don't have to prove strict scrutiny analysis. You don't have to prove there's a compelling government interest, that you did it by the least restrictive means. The state, the government can have these kinds of laws that infringe, that might have the effect or the impact of infringing upon one's free exercise of religion, as long as it's a neutral law of general applicability. In other words, they didn't just have a law against Native Americans using peyote. No one can use peyote for any reason, whether it's religious or a secular reason. Right. No one could use peyote. So he said, as long as it's a neutral law that not targeting a religion, then even if it has the impact or the effect of burdening someone's religious freedom, it's okay. That's a legal fiction, in my opinion. Respectfully, I've long disagreed with the court on this one because it is not in the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution that says religious freedom, unless it's neutral, general, applicable, unless you write the law a certain way, you can infringe on religious freedom. No, it says Congress shall not infringe on the free exercise of religion. All right. It's very clear. It's not, there's no asterisk there. And so just recently, Justices Alito, Thomas Gorsuch have indicated in a case called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia in 2022, and indicated a desire to overturn Employment Division v. Smith. They don't like it. That case wasn't quite the case to do it because they were able to decide it outside of the context of Employment Division v. Smith. And the court, whenever they can avoid having to directly overturn law, they'll do that. If they can find another way to get to the decision without having to overturn the law, very often they'll do that. And that's what happened in Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, which had to do with a Catholic foster agency that wouldn't serve same-sex couples, essentially. And they were able to do that outside of the Employment Division v. Smith. You might remember that case, an adoption agency. Mm-hmm. It was a very big case. But the reason it was getting so much talk, so much press in legal circles, was because it had the potential to overturn Employment Division v. Smith, which would have been very good for us. But we wouldn't even need to be at this point, because if had that been overturned, we would have probably already won our case. But because it wasn't, it provided us with a path to challenge it once again. And we think we have a perfect set of facts here for the court to take this case up. Why? It was not a neutral law of general applicability. They created this law to repeal only the religious exemption. You can keep the secular exemption. You can keep the medical exemption. But you can't have a religious reason for opting out. That sounds an awful lot like targeting religion and religious discrimination to me.
It sounds like,
I don't know about to you, Mike, but it does to me. And that you can't do that. You can't show a hostility to religion. Masterpiece Cake Shop, that decision, state of Colorado, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus state of Colorado with Jack Phillips. You remember that case? The wedding cakes. For gay couples, you cannot show hostility towards someone's religion. And that's what the state of Colorado did in that case. Same thing here. You're showing hostility to only those with certain beliefs, religious beliefs, against vaccination. Anyone else who doesn't have those religious beliefs can still access public education. If you have a medical reason, a secular reason, you can still access public education, just not a religious reason. Judge Joseph Bianco, an appointee of President Trump. So he served in the on the Second Circuit for, not terribly long, but for a few years now. he was one of the judges on our panel that we got at the Second Circuit. And so they didn't get a unanimous decision. It was a 2-1 decision. And just Judge Joseph Bianco was the lone dissent in our case and said that, you know, on the, for that reason, because you're still allowing secular conduct, this should not have been deemed a neutral law of general applicability under Smith. So that sort of greased the skids, his dissent, for us to write a really strong cert petition to the United States Supreme Court and say, hey, look, Judge Bianco, he was right here. And we expounded upon his reasoning in our petition. And like I said, now the state has to respond. They're being ordered to respond to us. This is a huge case. This is a case, honestly, in medical freedom circles should be the number one case being discussed. And I don't say that because it's our case. I say that simply because of the far-reaching impact. If this were anyone else's case, I'd agree with it. I'd say the same thing. This should be the number one case to watch, regardless of who brought it. Unfortunately, there's like any other arena in life, there's a lot of fighting for the spotlight in medical freedom and health freedom. And so there have been people purposely censoring this case.
Are there haters in this circle too?
Oh yeah, there's haters. Honestly, the censorship that we have from within our own community is worse than the censorship from big tech or outside, because our own community has the ability to get behind this case in a big way and to really support us and to prop up the work that we're doing. I'm not going to mention names. I don't do that. Okay, but there's certain players in this community that have purposely suppressed this news because they don't like the fact that we got this case to the Supreme Court. They don't want us to be the ones to win a victory. And so they're purposely not telling their supporters, and they have many more supporters. They have millions on their list. And again, that's not everybody. There's at least one very large organization that has promoted this case for us. And so I'm not saying it's everybody, but we're very grateful for those who have. But there are others who have a very big audience, a very big megaphone, who could be promoting this case and helping us and really helping get this message out to the world, but are purposely censoring it because it's not their case. So that kind of pettiness needs to stop, because our opponents, the people, the pro-vax people, pro-farmer people, pro-fascism people that are the real fascists that want to take away our individual freedoms and constitutional rights, they win. And they win big. Why do they win big? Because they all stick together, Mike.
Everybody toes the party line, right?
They toe the party line. There's infighting, but not like there is here.
Right.
On our side, everybody's in a silo. Nobody wants to work together. Not nobody. Almost nobody wants to work together. And so it's very, very hard for us to win any of these causes, because if you don't have the support of your supporters, your colleagues, if you're fighting even with them to get the word out, never mind the big tech censorship and mainstream media censorship, if you're fighting even your own like-minded people who are supposedly support your cause, they won't even help you. It's pretty difficult to succeed. So, you know, this is why we really, really need to get the word out. We need to ask for your support, because we are a nonprofit organization. All this work we've done is pro bono. We haven't charged any of our clients in this religious exemption case a penny. Okay. All of this has been donor funded. So in order for us to continue this work, I mean, just to get the copies of the petition printed was like, you know, $8,000, I think, something like that, just to get, because you need to actually have paper copies. When you file a petition to the Supreme Court, even though we're living in a digital age, you need to have copies for all the clerks, all the justices, all the attorneys working on the case, on your opponents, attorneys, everyone needs to get printed copies of your brief. And that's extraordinary. They have to be bound. They look like this. So here's one of the petitions that was written, a wonderful petition that was written in support of us from the Wagner Faith and Freedom Center out in Lansing, Michigan, and the Great Lakes Justice Center, wonderful organization. And they filed what's called an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief in support, but it has to be bound like this. It has to be an actual booklet. So you have to get an actual booklet like this printed and mailed, postage costs too, to every single person involved, all the lawyers, everything. So it's extraordinary. So even just that is a huge expense for an organization like ours, a nonprofit organization. And then you talk about paying attorneys to do this. You know, multiple attorneys have worked in this case. We've had a whole team of attorneys, including myself, that have worked on this case. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's for 3 years now, this litigation. Yeah. And this is just one lawsuit.
Yeah.
If I show you all the lawsuits we have all over the country, from New York to California, and you can imagine if it's, you know, if we're talking about, you know, tens of thousands, sometimes $100,000 for a lawsuit, just one lawsuit, can you imagine doing dozens of lawsuits, how much that's costing? And that doesn't even cover operational expenses or salaries or anything like that. So when you have an organization like this, it really takes millions of dollars to fund it. I mean, litigation, I mean, that shouldn't be surprising to anyone that it would take millions of dollars to operate a law firm. I mean, especially one that's
count on
nationwide.
Right. This is what they can. This is what we mean when we say lawfare. They bleed you dry because lawsuits are very, very expensive and they take a very, very long time. And are you really going to dedicate the next 5, 6, 7 years of your life and hundreds of thousands of dollars to this? Or are you just going to be quiet and go get the vaccination? I mean, this is, you know, this is the decision that people have to face. And if you're an ordinary person, you're going to say, gosh, well, you know, I'd love to fight the good fight, but how am I supposed to do that? I have to put dinner on the table. I have to survive. And that's why organizations like yours are vital. This is the magic here. So I want you to tell us a little bit about the work that you guys do. You've already mentioned a few things, but tell us a little bit more.
Well, it's not just us. So just as I won't mention anyone who's doing anything nefarious, funny business, not playing nice in the sandbox. I'm professional. I will mention by name people who have been supportive of us. Fair enough. Wagner Faith and Freedom Center, excellent. Great Lakes Justice Institute, please support them. Also, Physicians for Informed Consent, who also filed an amicus brief in support of us. Please support them. My friend Greg Glazier is the lead counsel over there and wrote this brief. He's out in San Francisco fighting the good fight in the belly of the beast. So I strongly, strongly suggest that you support them as well. And there's so many great organizations that are doing work. So please don't misunderstand me. This is not the We the Patriot show. Promote, plug, only us. We're the only ones doing good work. No. Okay, there are a lot of organizations doing good work, but the point I was making before is that all of those organizations need to be funded, and we all need to be working together with one voice, one mission. We need to be doing that together. Not when I say one voice, we don't all have to say the same things, but with one cause, one unified front. We need to mount a unified front to win this war, because it is a war. And ladies and gentlemen, it's a spiritual warfare. Okay. Yes. We're not wrestling against flesh and blood. Yes. We wrestle against powers and principalities. You know that from the Bible, but it is so true. This is spiritual warfare. And so what we need to do is all band together, and we need to win this together. Okay. They ruined the phrase during COVID. We're all in this together. So I won't ever say that. But I will say, we all need to stand together. We all need to fight together, because united we stand, divided we fall, right? They didn't ruin that one. All right. So let's keep doing that. And yes, the work that we do, not only religious exemption cases, we have medical kidnapping cases. Last year, a family in Missouri, 4 of their children were taken away from them by the state of Missouri simply because they were using an alternative medical treatment to treat their autistic 6-year-old son. A treatment known as chlorine dioxide, very low risk. There was no evidence that he was having any harmful side effects. No, it's not drinking bleach. It's a couple drops of solution in a big glass of water. Perfectly safe for him. He was not a doctor, but in their case, he was experiencing no side effects. There was no evidence of harm. Yet they said, we're going to take all 4 of your children away because you're using this, because they found one pediatrician to write a note about the possible potential risks of using an alternative treatment. They snatched the children away, threw them into foster care. This child's nonverbal, scared out of his mind, doesn't know what's happening to him. He got shipped around to 4 different homes because they couldn't deal with him, with his behaviors and everything. They weren't trained. He's on the spectrum, of course. We stepped in, and we had local counsel in Missouri partner with us. That's what we do. We partner with local counsel in all these different states. We stepped in, and within a matter of weeks, we're able to get all 4 children back in the home and get the state to back down and leave these parents alone. This is the kind of stuff we need to be doing. Beyond that, We had a case last year in defense of Second Amendment rights. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham in New Mexico, total tyrant there, said anywhere in public cities, like the city of Albuquerque, especially in public places, parks, playgrounds, anywhere in public, no more carrying firearms. I don't care whether you have a permit, you don't have a permit, no more firearms.
Yeah.
We went after her, filed the temporary restraining order. We won the temporary restraining order. Then we filed for a preliminary injunction. Unfortunately, they didn't rule in our favor there. So now it's on appeal to the 10th Circuit in Colorado. Out in Denver, we're at the 10th Circuit now there. We have two other Second Amendment lawsuits, one in defense of a combat veteran who is being denied the right to carry in a post office. Post offices should not be banned. He's a combat veteran. And then also another Connecticut repealed their open carry statute that allowed for the open carry. They passed a ban on open carry of firearms that had been in place forever. This is the Constitution state, supposedly. We have a case against them. We have a case on behalf of an Oakland, California kindergarten teacher that's being fired, devout Catholic woman being fired because she's refusing to use preferred pronouns in the classroom. 5-year-old female student, and they tell her, you have to start calling her a boy and using male pronouns. She's like, listen, I wouldn't even know how, number one, it's against my religion, but number two, I wouldn't even know where to begin. This is a dual immersion classroom, Spanish and English. I teach Spanish and English. She's a Hispanic woman. She teaches Morella Ramirez. She's like, it's not just pronouns that you need to change the gender for. It's nouns and everything else. She's like, I can't do that in the classroom. I can't keep changing genders like that. So it wasn't practical. It also was an infringement of her religious freedom. She is now filing a lawsuit because they're firing her. They've suspended her without pay, but they're moving in the final stages of termination. We're defending her in that. I could go on and on and on and on and on. Taryn Gregson, who was a longtime host of our podcast, Faithful Freedom, Taryn Gregson, former PGA Tour reporter, was fired because they wouldn't let her opt out of the masking and testing requirements. She was pregnant at the time. Her ratings were the highest they'd ever been for her show on the PGA Tour when she was working from her home studio, and they were forcing her to come in the office and mask and test. She said, listen, I have, you know, a religious objection to these things. They denied it. They fired her. So we're in federal court in Florida over that, too. So anyway, I can go on and on and on. But as you can see, this is coast to coast litigation. We're in New Mexico. We're in Florida. We're in California. We're in Connecticut. We have cases against Bristol-Myers Squibb, against Takeda Pharmaceuticals, huge pharmacy giants in the Northeast. East Palestine, Ohio, the train derailment. The EPA and the state of Ohio lied to the people there. They were poisoned. Their water, their air, everything with that train derailment, that controlled burn that wasn't really such a controlled burn. They lied to the people. We filed against them. Anywhere. Here's the common thread. Because you say, Brian, you're all over the place. All right. And I just wrote a Substack about this the other day. Please subscribe to our Substack, Free the Law. It's called Free the Law. We the Patriots USA Substack. Anyway, if you look at the Substack I just wrote, I talked about this. I said, some people think we're all over the place. You're into Second Amendment rights. You're into vaccine stuff. You're into medical kidnapping. You're into the LGBTQ transgender wars. You're into East Palestine, Ohio. What are you guys doing? You're all over the place. No, we're not. We're not over the place. We're laser focused. You know what we're focused on? Fighting overreach, corporate and government overreach, limitations on power. Every single one of our lawsuits has that common thread. Okay, fighting abuses of power in the government and in big corporations like Big Pharma. We had a lawsuit last year and the year before, actually, against Walmart and Hy-Vee supermarkets because their pharmacist denied ivermectin to a retired U.S. Marine, a hero, who was very sick. He and his wife were both sick with COVID, and they needed to ivermectin. That was out in Minnesota. So we had a case not last year, a year before last, on behalf of a young woman who was being a teenager, was being denied a kidney transplant because she wouldn't get the COVID shot. And yeah, we were able to fight and get her the treatment she needed. So, I mean, we're all over the place in one sense. Yes, we're all over the country. We're all over the place in the geographic sense. Yeah. But in the sense of our litigation, it's all fighting abuses of power, placing limitations on power, corporate and government overreach, especially government, but also corporate. It's all focused on that one mission. It's laser focused, actually.
Listen, you said it a moment ago. You said it's the spiritual. Once you understand, and I shied away from characterizing it this way for a long time, but once you understand that this is a battle between good and evil, it all begins to make sense and it all ties together. In addition to all these lawsuits, you guys are actually also in the documentary business. Tell us about Shot Dead.
Filmmaker.
That's right.
I never thought in my life I'd be attending film festivals and entering film festivals and filmmaking. Totally. Listen, I'm a lawyer. That's my background. I have a lot of, you know, professional experience in different arenas, but never in filmmaking. Taryn Gregson, who I just mentioned, is the former TVA PGA Tour reporter. A lot of experience in broadcasting, along with two amazing filmmakers, Jason and Avery Kabrick. Jason is a professional. He does everything from, you know, video work on Dave Ramsey's show to Fox Sports. He was at the Super Bowl this year doing video work. This guy's a professional videographer, but he's on our side. He's one of us. He believes in the cause. He's committed. He worked with Taryn and was let go by the PGA Tour as well. And so the three of them got together with us, with We the Patriots, said, listen, we want to make a movie about the harm of these COVID shots. We all got together, got our heads together and said, how are we going to do this? You know, other movies have already been made. We had Died Suddenly. We had The Unseen Crisis, I think it was. And so we said, what are we going to do? We don't want to just repeat what others have done, okay? Because that's not, you know, we're not copycats, number one. But also, we want to bring an angle that people haven't seen about this, because we think there's another angle here that's not being covered. There's something here that we've seen. People have been reaching out and telling us stories over and over again, and it hasn't been featured really in any of those other documentaries. So let's feature it. It's children. The effect this has had on children and the deaths of children. I think the reason other people probably haven't taken it on, I'm not talking about the other two films, but just people in general haven't taken on this angle, is it's extraordinarily heartbreaking. And quite frankly, most people don't want to watch a movie about kids dying.
Correct.
Okay. So that's why initially there was some hesitation. Do we really want to do this? Do we really want to focus on this? And we initially said, you know, we were wavering on it. We weren't sure it was the right thing to do, but these families really wanted their stories told. And we said, you know what? This is the only way we're going to get justice for these kids is by showcasing their stories. Three children who died, one just 11 hours after birth, one a 16-year-old just 5 days after receiving the Pfizer shot, and one an 18-year-old just 3 months and also 3 months from her initial shot, and it looks like 2 or 3 weeks since her booster shot. She passed away too. None of them had pre-existing health conditions. The baby, obviously, it was in utero. Her mother took it, but very, you know, extraordinary complication that's known to be caused by things like these vaccinations, this inflammatory response. We had Dr. Peter McCullough and Dr. James Thorpe featured also in the film, along with whistleblower nurse Michelle Gershman, and we interviewed all of them. And we really let the parents, though, take the lead and tell the stories. There's no narrator, okay? Taryn did the interview. She was the director, but she's not seen anywhere in the film. It's focused just on the families telling their stories, and, of course, then on the doctors and the nurse. But, you know, some people said, well, there's only three stories there. That's not enough. People aren't going to see the full scope of carnage. But, you know, when the doctors talk about it, they do show some of the statistics. We didn't want to focus on 150 different stories or something, or even 100 or even 50, because then you can't really, unless your documentary is 17 hours long, you can't really fully tell the story of each family that was harmed.
Correct.
You can't adequately do that if you're jumping all over the place. If you're only spending 3 minutes on each family's story, that's not really giving you the in-depth look at the grief, the heartache, the suffering these families have had to endure. And right. That's what we wanted to showcase, to leave that with people, to say, look at what they've done. Look at how they've destroyed these, not just these children's lives, but their whole family's lives because of this. These families will never be the same.
Yes.
Okay? These
yes.
parents have lost their children.
Yes.
They will never be the same.
Yes.
And we wanted to shine a bright spotlight on that. The documentary is only 1 hour and 8 minutes long. We didn't want it too long because people have short attention spans. They won't stay and watch something 2, 3, 4 hours. It's not happening. Okay. So we condensed it into just 1 hour and 8 minutes, but there's heavy focus on the families. We're in their living rooms. We're in the children's bedrooms. We're in the grave size of the children. You've seen it, I'm sure. That's the focus. And we wanted to have the children and the families be front and center. So again, it's an extraordinary documentary. It's already, it was an official selection of the Santa Monica Film Festival, unbelievably.
Right.
Santa Monica Film Festival in Santa Monica, Southern California.
Right.
It was also It's also an official selection of the Documentaries Without Borders Festival in Delaware. It just won an award for Best Documentary in the bi-monthly film festival in Boston, the Boston Indie Film Festival. So that puts it in the running for Best Documentary of the Year for their big festival in January of next year. So we've got already, you know, accolades coming in from Southern California, Boston, Delaware. We're all over the country. We've applied to film festivals all over the world as well. We're getting the word out. We want as many people as possible, as many eyes as possible on this film to get this message out. Again, we did this purely with donor money. We didn't charge any of these families. We paid expenses for our film crew to travel from Texas to West Virginia to Oklahoma to California, where all these things were filmed. So this was an extraordinarily difficult and expensive project for us, but we only were able to do it through the generous support of our donors. So all of that, you know, we thank our donors. We are so grateful to our donors, but we need to keep doing this. People are already asking us for a sequel. There's so many more stories to be told. What about the people that have lost their spouses? All those other, you know, the hospital protocols. Please make a film about that. People are asking us to, and we want to, but we don't have any money left to do that. We need to replenish that. We need someone to get behind us. Anyone, if there's any one of your listeners, I don't know how big your listenership is, but I don't really care. I mean, you care, but it could be 20 people. It could be 20 million people. It's somewhere in between, I bet. But even if only 25 or 50 people hear this podcast, if there's even one person who's listening right now that has the means or knows someone that has the means to help us in a very big way and invest, invite them first to watch Shot Dead.
Yeah.
If they're moved by that film speaks for itself. That film shows the kind of work product we can produce if we have funding behind us. And we can do even greater things than that if we have real funding behind us. We've done all of this on a shoestring budget. I'm gonna put it right out there because it's public information anyway. We have to file. We're a nonprofit 501c3, so generally any donations are tax deductible that are made to our organization. You can deduct it on your taxes. So we have to publish the statement though of all of our financials.
Yes.
So it's public information anyway. But our total operating budget, I mean, last year when we did this, we're talking less than $500,000. Okay. Other organizations that have tens of millions of dollars haven't even produced this.
Right.
So that tells you we're good stewards of our money. And that if you're investing in us, that money is going to go a really long way. If we get a donation of $500,000 or $1 million, it's going to be what to some organizations, we're going to be able to do with that what some organizations would need $5 or $10 million to do, because we really know how to stretch a dollar and how to utilize it. Because we have connections with people that do things with us. I don't want to say on the cheap because I don't want to make it sound cheap, but that do things because they believe in our mission and our causes, that do things for us at heavily discounted rates.
Yeah.
Even though this was a very expensive project for us, Jason and Avery didn't charge us even a quarter of what it would have cost us to get this done if they were charging their full rate, what they can really get as professionals. We got a heavily discounted rate. So we were able to do this at a fraction of the cost. So again, if you invest the money, we can continue doing things. And by the way, they don't want more money. They want to continue doing it. In fact, they donate to us. I'm like, why are you guys making donations? You've already given us so much of your time. You've already given us this huge discount, and I'm getting these donations coming in. I'm like, they support us so much. They're so dedicated to this cause. They're wonderful, God-fearing Christian people, wonderful individuals, beautiful family there. They travel all around the country doing this. They even take their daughter with them. They go everywhere, all over the country. They're wonderful individuals, but they believe in the mission. So they can continue producing films like this for us if we just get a little bit of funding for it. So please, if anyone's listening, WeThePatriotsUSA.org, there's a donate button right front and center at the top, and also in the center of the page, the bottom of every page, WeThePatriotsUSA.org/donate if you want the direct link. And then also some people, Mike, are worried about donating electronically. They don't like using credit cards to donate, or yeah, they want to donate anonymously. Well, you can do that too. We do have a mailing address. It's right at the bottom of every one of our web pages at WeThePatriotsUSA.org. And you can make what's called a payment through a donor advised fund. If you're not familiar with that, that's where you go to a fund like Fidelity Charitable, or there's a whole host of them, Vanguard, Schwab. There's a whole host of them, but you basically set up an account on there and you can donate anonymously. You make a donation through that, it's like a grant essentially through that donor advised fund, and it can be made anonymously. So your name doesn't show up on the payment. But you could send any amount. I mean, you could send 25,000, 50,000, 100,000, a million through that, and we'd never know who you are. And it's completely just tracked through the donor advised fund through Fidelity or whatever, not through your bank account or anything like that. So there's ways to do it, because I know people are afraid these days. Hell, I don't want to support a patriot organization. I don't want my name linked. Isn't that
Correct.
awful?
Correct.
Isn't that
Yes.
awful, the America we live in?
Yes.
People don't want to be associated with patriots.
Yes.
Okay. I remember, there's a very popular movie that came out starring Mel Gibson in the 90s called The Patriot. Remember
Right.
that?
Yes.
And everybody loved it, liberals and conservatives alike. That was a huge thing. Oh, this movie, you're going to see it, The Patriot, this new Mel Gibson movie. It's great. The Patriot, The Patriot. Now, that would never be made with that title.
It's a
You'd never be
dirty
able to make
word,
that movie.
right? It's a dirty word. And then, I mean, this is the goal of our friends on the other side, and I use that term friends loosely. They want to invert the world. They want the good to become bad. They want the bad to become good. And that's what it's all about. And that's why I wanted to have you guys on, because you guys are walking the walk, as you just laid out there. And I'm glad that you mentioned how far you can make money stretch, because again, when you have limited resources, you want to make sure that you're getting the biggest bang for your buck, even if you're giving to charity. And so, I think as we've proven here in this discussion, We the Patriots is a very good place to put your money if you're looking for a place of value for your charitable contributions. So we're going to put all these links in the show notes. Before we let you go, please tell the folks, give the folks the address to that website one more time.
So again, it's we the Patriots USA.org. And if you want to mail us a check or go to a donor advised fund, it's 5210 Cleveland Boulevard, Building 140, Suite 222. And that's in Caldwell, Idaho, 83607. But you don't have to write that down or pause it, remember any of that. Just go to we the Patriots USA.org, scroll to the bottom of the page, and our address is right there. Also, on the donate page, not only is our address there, but our federal employer identification number is there, which you will need if you donate through a donor advised fund. So that's how they look us up. But that FEIN number is listed right there. So again, the easiest thing to remember is just wethepatriotsusa.org. Go to the donate page. All the information you need about donor advised funds, about our address, our FEIN, it's all there. Plus, of course, electronic donating options are there as well. That's the easiest way to remember. We greatly, I don't care. Like I said, even one person listens to this, donates, I would be so grateful, because so many people have the attitude, I think, of, someone else take care of it. Sort of like, my
Correct.
friend Kristen Megan Kelly, that's done great work. She's an industrial hygienist. Her and her partner in crime there, Tammy Clark, they go all over the country talking about this. But one thing she often says, it's sort of like you drive by, a car wreck or something, you see other people helping. Okay. They've got it. I don't need to help. Other people are attending to it. Other people are going. But as Kristen says, this is just, this isn't even that. It's just, skip one cup of coffee a week or something. You could be donating to We the Patriots USA, $5 a month, $10 a month donation, because we do have monthly donation options. And that's tremendously impactful. If thousands of people were doing that, that would be a tremendous impact. But the point is, unfortunately, out of everyone that listens to this podcast, probably only 1% or less are going to actually go onto the website and donate or send in a check. That's sad. I don't know what they would need to motivate them. It saddens me. And listen, I'm as guilty as everyone else. I spend money sometimes on frivolous things. Not every dollar I give goes to charity. Okay. So if people say, well, the economy is too hard, we can't even give $5. We can't even give $1 a month. It's just too hard. Then how come every morning when I'm out driving by Starbucks or whatever else, I see the line for the drive-through going around the building and out to the street? If nobody has even $5 in a month, how are they getting, $6, $7 per morning to get a coffee? Now listen, I'm not saying give up coffee. Drink as much as you want, all right? But at the well, within reason. But at the end of the day, one of those coffees could, if thousands of people were each giving up just one of those, that would make a tremendous impact on fighting for our freedoms and saving lives, really. We're talking about saving lives.
Well, because today this problem is not affecting you, any of these problems that you've outlined here in this episode. But listen, tomorrow it might. They're coming for all of us. That's what I think people need to
Until there's no one
internalize.
left but you to come for it, right? Just
That's
like that old poem goes, or that old story goes, right? So, you know, don't think someone else has got it. Someone else is going to donate, because the majority of people don't. The reality is, if you donate, you'll be one of the few who listens to this. Like I said, if there's 25, 50, 100 people that listen to this, one person might donate. So please be that one person. It'll make a tremendous difference. And listen, if you want any proof, we're very transparent. I'm very open. If you want a personal call with me to discuss giving in a substantial way, even a major gift, I'm going to put it right out there. Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at wethepatriotsusa.org. That's my personal email. Goes directly to me, Brian at wethepatriotsusa.org. Talk to me about what you'd like to do. If you have questions about our organization, you want more information about our financials, we're very transparent. You want to see the actual lawsuits we filed, every press release that's on our website, every post, when we have a legal update, go to our legal updates tab. It links directly to the filing with the stamp from the court and everything. You can see everything that's been filed. So it proves your money's going towards these lawsuits. We don't just talk the talk. We walk the walk, and I'll turn over the documents to you to prove where your money's going. Okay. And so I don't know many other organizations that offer that level of transparency, where the co-founder of the organization, I'm the vice president and co-founder, offers you his personal time, offers to turn over papers and financials and everything to you. That's what I'll offer. You know, whatever it takes, I will prove to you that we are an organization worth supporting.
Hard to ask for anything more. Listen, Brian, thank you very much for taking the time, and thank you for educating us on all your great work. Please come back real soon.
Thank you, Mike. You have a great day. God bless.
God bless.